Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast of the New Books Network. My name is Sebastian Truhl, your host, and today I will talk to Hannah Wallerstein and Jordan Osserman, this time not about a book actually, but about a special issue of the journal The Psychoanalytic Study of the Child, titled Transgender Children, From Controversy to Dialogue, which they edited and which came out, I think, last year, although I'm not really sure about that. I think it's end of last year, but the volume's this year or something. The subject's very interesting, and it's also a very interesting format they've chosen to approach it, but you'll hear more about that in a bit. Let me first introduce the two of them. Hannah Wallerstein is a psychologist and psychoanalyst in private practice in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She's faculty at the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, adjunct faculty at the Austin Rick Center, and clinical supervisor for the CCNY doctoral program. Hannah has written about gender identity and transgender phenomena, psychosis and historical trauma, and most recently, the collapse between biology and ontology and psychoanalytic thinking on the body. And Jordan Osserman is a lecturer in the Department of Psychosocial and Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex, UK, and a clinical trainee with the Site for Contemporary Psychoanalysis in London. Jordan's current research involves an ethnographic study of the UK's only publicly funded clinic for children struggling with gender identity. And his book, which is out last year, I think, Circumcision on the Couch, The Cultural, Psychological, and Gender Dimensions of the World's Oldest Surgery, was published by Bloomsbury Press. And Jordan, as some of you might also know, is a host of New Books in Psychoanalysis as well. So it's really nice to have him as an interview partner here. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. And nice to experience being a guest as opposed to a host this time.
Yeah, definitely. Although this is not a book, I really wanted to do this interview because I think the topic is very important, obviously, on a lot of our minds and clinicians' minds at the moment. But I think what makes the special issue you edited very very important is that you actually chose a very different format than we're used to. So it's not contributors you asked who wrote a paper each, and there's no sort of interaction between them, but you actually had them interact. Could you tell us a bit about what you decided to do with the special issue and also maybe a bit why you decided to do it that way? Who wants to start?
Hannah, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, I mean, I can say something about the basic reasoning we went for a dialogue, and then maybe, Jordan, you can share more about the specific structure.
Sure.
that makes sense. So, you know, in terms of the topic of trans children, we felt that there was just so much polarization within the field. I mean, there is in general in psychoanalytic thinking about gender, but it's even more so when it comes to thinking about children. And also, I think there's more thorny aspects of it that are actually just quite difficult to think through, like around medical intervention or around adult responsibility, these questions that are, you know, difficult. And given that, I think we felt both for our own interest and also just in terms of intervening on how split off the different ideas can be, that it made sense to bring people's thinking into a more live exchange with one another than simply having papers that were formed in isolation.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I would add, but partly, I mean, one of the ways that Hannah and I got to speaking about this is I had really admired a piece that she'd written in the same journal for, that she'd co-written rather, in the same journal for an earlier issue on trans kids, an earlier special section several years before we worked on this one. And that was, as Hannah was saying, it was kind of a series of articles by clinicians about you know, their views on trans kids and how to work with them, and it seemed to make sense that the next step or kind of evolution in that kind of conversation was actually to stage a live conversation where people could actually, you know, confront one another with their ideas, discuss their differences, and have to think on their feet a little bit. So really. I believe, Hannah, right, you were sort of asked by the journal editor, would you be interested in doing another, in working on a new section on trans kids? And then we kind of brainstormed what might be an appropriate, you know, way to do it a bit differently than how it was done previously, and came up with this idea. Also, it was kind of what we were more or less in the midst of lockdown at the time, right? But that kind of,
I guess so,
presented,
yeah,
the opportunity of using Zoom, or we'd all become, right, more comfortable, right, with Zoom at that point.
Good point. Right. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, so the history to this special section of the journal is actually that you mentioned this, right? There was an issue that came out in 2014, I think, mm-hmm, that had pretty much this, was focusing on the same topic, on trans kids, right?
That's
so,
right.
Maybe you could say a bit more about, in from your perspective, what has changed since then?
Good question.
Yeah. So much and so little in some ways. I mean, I suppose at the time that first issue was published, it probably seemed already like trans kids were such a sort of topical thing in the news that people were discussing. But then by the time we got around to working on this, it was, you know, daily, you read headlines about people's, you know, political and clinical views on young people, you know, struggling with questions about their gender identity, which has only intensified, I mean, since we worked on this. So, I mean, one of the things that we discussed in the introduction is the context in the UK. And at the time of writing the introduction, there was a high court decision which affected the ability of young people to access puberty blockers. After that introduction was published, that high court decision was overturned. And then, of course, in the US context, there's been all kinds of issues around states criminalizing the medical practitioners who offer basically healthcare to young people with gender dysphoria. So day after day, the news around this subject just seems to intensify, and also the polarization around it.
It's really interesting because you mentioned something in the introduction as well, this that sort of relates to that. As you were trying to, you know, to gather a group of thinkers, of clinicians, scholars about this issue, there were actually some difficulties, right? You're describing, like, you approached some people, you wanted to get someone actually from the Gender Identity Development Service, I think, in the UK also, But many people felt like they either felt too vulnerable to address the issue publicly, felt like, I think you mentioned that some felt like they didn't want to be in discussion with some of the other people that you had asked. So that alone was very interesting to read, and you making actually that process public was very interesting to read. Can you say a bit more about that process of actually finding a group of people willing to talk to each other publicly?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'm trying to think what to say about it. It certainly was difficult, and you know, the worries that people raised were also understandable given how charged the topic can be. And I mean, I think we tried to steer clear, or it was clear to us that we wanted both a spectrum of perspectives and also to not have any one that was, you know, explicitly transphobic or you know, we steered clear of what we felt like were going to be disrespectful positions. And yet, even with that, there was still a lot, you know, as you said, there were people who felt like they couldn't speak with other people on the panel because they were too anti-trans or things like this. I don't know, Jordan, if you want to say more about Tavistock in particular, given your connection there and the concern.
I mean, yeah, I would just say, yeah, recruitment, it was probably the biggest hurdle of the entire project. And I don't want to go into too much detail about, you know, the particularities of, you know, what people were going through when they said no. But just to say, I mean, the Tavistock is under a tremendous amount of scrutiny. In addition to that, it's a place where people are working very long hours and don't have very much time. So, you know, it wasn't surprising, but it was, you know, unfortunate that that was one of the places where we really hoped to get a contributor and weren't successful. We did kind of, part of the introduction was putting a lot of thought into, as you said, the questions about why recruitment was so hard, and also just, you know, what is the political context around trans issues and its relationship to psychoanalysis in the UK.
Right. Before we get more into you know, the question of why this issue tends to blow up so much, let's maybe first talk about who you did actually get to be involved in this process. You have four scholars who are involved in this, right? Four people who are pretty well known for having researched trans issues and issues about trans children. Could you maybe tell us a bit about who you got and what sort of perspectives these people represent?
Yeah, maybe I'll mention too, Hannah, and maybe you could fill in for the other two. One thing I should say off the bat is, although we've just talked about how difficult recruitment is, in no way is that meant to imply that any of the people that we worked with were in any way kind of second choice. They're an absolutely phenomenal group of people that we got involved. But it just took a lot of time to finally secure them. So two of them, one, some listeners might be familiar with Oren Goslan. He has written, he's published quite extensively on trans issues. He's got a book called Transsexuality and the Art of Transitioning, a Lacanian Approach. And he's a psychoanalyst working in Toronto. And although he does have a kind of Lacanian direction, he's also kind of, I think, a bit more eclectic than that. And then I suppose I'll also just mention Tobias Wiggins. So he was the one non-psychoanalyst, although he does have quite an interest in the clinic. He's a academic and assistant professor of women's and gender studies at Athabasca University in Canada. And he's published quite extensively in the field of trans studies, and particular kind of links between thinking around issues of transphobia and psychoanalysis. And I think was particularly useful as someone who was able to articulate perspectives kind of from the area of trans studies that often takes a more critical stance towards psychoanalysis, which is something we thought was quite important to include.
And then, so the other two, so Laurel Silber is a clinical psychologist, a psychoanalytic clinical psychologist who works primarily with children in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. And, you know, she was, as it turns out, the only child analyst that we were able to get who works with not just adolescents, but also children. And she has been a longtime advocate of child therapy, has written a lot about various aspects to it, and more recently had written a paper that we both quite liked on gender variance in children and how she thinks about it and works with it clinically. And, you know, I mean, I think it was very important to have her voice as someone who comes from working with children more experientially than the others. And she provided a very useful vignette, which we might talk about among other things. And then the last person we had was Eve Watson, who's a psychoanalyst and lecturer in Dublin, Ireland, who has done a lot of work in various aspects of sexuality studies and psychoanalysis from a Lacanian perspective. And she's a co-author of a book, I believe, with Noreen Gifney, and had written herself a book chapter about child trans issues around children and thinking, again, we thought in interesting ways around around gender and children and I guess parental fantasies and how that plays out in relation to positions people take up in relation to children.
Right. So, and thanks for mentioning all four of them. And I think it's just to say a thing about the process, you asked all four of them to write a very short, very brief paper, sort of highlighting their thoughts on trans kids and on working with trans kids, but also on some theoretical implications of working with trans. And then you facilitated a Zoom, a live discussion that you then transcribed and edited, right? And I wanted to get right into some of the material that showed up in the short papers, because what was very interesting to me is actually that, for example, Laurel Silber's paper, but also, and more explicitly, Wiggins's paper, sort of have an approach to the topic that sort of turns around the focus, sort of, I guess, in a way, away from trans kids to the clinicians working with them, or I guess you could also say to the parents being confronted with gender questioning kids, and also I guess to a certain extent on what adults use children for, I guess you could say, in more implicit ways than, you know, actively abusing or misusing them, but more unconsciously putting fantasies into them. And I thought there was a very, very important issue, not just in relation to trans kids, but to trans people in general, how they're used by the public as, you could say, containers for certain issues that all of us have with our gender, or I guess just issues with sexuality as well. And I thought it was very important to sort of make that change of perspective explicit.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, because I think in some sense, all of the contributors at one point or another, I think, made a point around that, the way in which children become, as you said, a kind of container for people's anxieties. And, you know, it's often parodied, like this idea of some terrified adults, you know, screaming, "Think of the children," or "Save the children." And obviously when they say that, they're not really thinking about children. And yeah, I think that was one of the useful kind of contributions that came out of this dialogue, that it's quite surprising the degree to which it's often missing when you hear some psychoanalysts speak about trans issues, that that there often is not that much kind of a critical perspective of, you know, what might be my own investment in this panic or anxiety about what's happening to the kids. You don't hear that as much as you should. So it was nice that, that became something that our contributors focused on.
What I thought was very interesting in that respect also, and that's something that's probably maybe just closer to my mind, as a psychiatrist or a medical doctor, is how objectified the discourse around trans people and trans kids specifically tends to be. And I'm wondering if it has to do with the fact that there's medicine involved lots of the time, right? There's medication involved, there's surgery involved, and this whole apparatus in the background of medical interventions. I don't know, there seems to be a lot of regulatory anxiety that stems from that specific context in which a lot of these issues, a lot of discussion around these issues tends to originate from, right? The medical perspective.
What did you mean by objectified? Just want to clear on that.
Just what we were just talking about, that there's so little talk, even within psychoanalysis in some accounts, about counter-transferential reactions, or even the analyst's own transference that they bring to the issue of trans. And there's in some accounts, I guess, a sense, not in this issue, right? I'm not saying in this issue, but in general, there seems to be a sense of we get to talk about trans issues or trans people from an outside perspective, and objectifying them in a sense asking what's wrong with them, like sort of pathologizing them. And I think it's a merit of this issue that doesn't happen as much.
Yeah, I mean, that is clear. And I mean, there's so many different contributions to that, but certainly the medical questions is a part of that. I mean, there's, I think, so much anxiety linked to gender more generally, right? But both anxiety about bodily transformation and intervention, and then also the question of, I think it does raise a lot of questions, and some of them I think are also understandable and important in terms of responsibility with children, right? And like, how does one think about that when it comes to altering the body? And I think it does raise the anxiety quite high, for so many reasons, but I think you're right to point to the piece that involves medication or bodily intervention, anything that alters the physicality of the person seems to heighten all of the worries, say, about responsibility when it comes to kids, which are already there and already part of the picture and all the ways that children are used.
There's actually a very interesting point, Hannah, that I wanted to bring up in from the discussion, right, from the transcribed discussion, in which sort of there's a point in which most of the contributors sort of agree around the issue of regret, right? That regret in itself is not a bad thing and cannot be omitted anyway, and regret is part of the picture, right? And you bring up this point of, well, there's actually an issue about that with kids, because kids are so dependent on their environment, on their objects, right? On their very real objects. And kids sort of, I guess, how to put that, get to feel very intense emotions, make very intense demands, and sort of, I guess, have the luxury of not having direct results from that right away, right? I mean, that's pretty different to adult life. And you bring that up, actually, and you bring that up in a very, I think, an amazing picture. You know, if a baby, for example, had their way, it might kill, like, all the people surrounding it in a moment of fury. And it's good that that's not a possibility. So, and I think those two sides, right, are very important in the discussion and how we might go forward, right? One thing being, like, you know, regret it. Like, I call this sort of a pessimistic generativity that psychoanalysis in general brings to the table, I think, saying, you know, we can't omit regret. There's always going to be some regret. And I think that's also a very important point in some of the papers. And on the other hand, the dependency of children, right, and sort of being entrusted to the real objects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think neither side can be total, right? Of course, like that, it would be awful if children were given no choice about anything and weren't able to make any decisions about themselves and their bodies, etc. And given free rein also would be a very terrifying picture for a child as well. But it doesn't lead to clear answers about what does that mean then, about how do adults help and manage making these decisions about things with children. And it doesn't lead to any clear-cut answers if that makes sense, around where those lines are.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I was thinking as I was actually rereading the dialogue before we began this interview, that actually it seemed as if there was a lot of great material that the contributors offered around this question of regret. I really liked, I think Eve put it as regret is the superego's fuel and one of the most useless affects, which has really resonated with me, you know, beyond thinking about trans kids, just in general, thinking about clinical work. But when Hannah put that question to our contributors about how do we think about the fact that perhaps one of the necessities of what it means to be a child is to be protected from a certain degree of responsibility for your actions, to not be responsible for your actions. And how do we think about that in relationship to medical care and you know, what kids are and aren't able to do with their bodies? I think there was a bit more hesitation and less participation in that question, precisely because of how difficult it was, which is not to say that it, you know, was pro or anti the question of offering puberty blockers or whatever else, but I think it was quite a difficult one to think about.
Yeah, and I think the tension also comes out in the issue of childism, right? Wiggins as well as Silber used this concept that was coined by Elizabeth Young-Brühl about, as I was saying before, how children are used by adults for their own unconscious purposes. But what that actually means in the consulting room or in work with trans kids also medically is a completely different, or is an issue that's not defined by the concept, right? Because you could make the point that some people use trans kids, you know, to further their own, I guess, idealization of fluidity or of not being fixed to gender and you know, the free choice of kids and whatever, and then some other kids would probably be used for a very rigid gender, quote unquote, gender critical agenda, right? So I guess the concept doesn't really explain the phenomenology then.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I did find something Oren said really fascinating on this subject too, just as a kind of observation of a historical shift that traditionally psychoanalysis was very concerned with people, you know, kind of traditional psychoanalysts were concerned with people fitting into the right gender category. And in fact, you know, you have figures like Robert Stoller who enabled people to undergo medical transition precisely so that if they didn't fit into the sex they were assigned at birth, then they would fit more properly into the gender they transitioned to. So that was the kind of traditional setup. And nowadays, you have psychoanalysts who are very against people transitioning, who instead seem to sort of fetishize gender fluidity as a kind of ideal, that kids and adults ought to be comfortable with being in between. Just a kind of, it really reframed things for me, the way that, you know, psychoanalysis has moved possibly from one fetish to another.
It's also like, in addition to it, any position being able to be used in that way, that's much more about the parents or the clinician's fantasies or needs than the child's. It also, sorry, I don't know how to put this, it's also not clear in any one position. Like, the answer also is not then having no thoughts or positions oneself. In other words, the difference also between figuring out what is using a child in the service of one's own needs and responsible caregiving is also very hard to sort out, in addition to any one position. Being, you know, that it's multiply hard to sort out how to not, you know, use children essentially for adult needs.
And you wonder to what extent that always happens, right? Like, I mean, to what degree, I guess, would be the question that has to be raised. But there's probably always an element of that in every interaction of caretaker and children, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot has to do with the fixity of what the fantasies are. In other words, I mean, maybe this is more so with parents than with analysts, but I think there always has to be fantasies and projections onto children. One has to have some way of imagining them and their future, but whether those can then be altered in response to what a child says, you know, what they communicate, or whether those become so fixed and needed that they maintain. I think that, in my mind, is where the difference is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This is a kind of large reflection, but this really is also the core of, in some ways, strikes at the heart of psychoanalysis, because this essentially was, you know, Freud's discovery of infantile sexuality was precisely this, you know, dealing with this issue of the fact that it was blatantly obvious that children have a sexuality, and yet adults and caretakers and, you know, parents were not willing to see what was right in front of them, right? And that... due to their own projections or unwilling, you know, investment in protecting the innocence of the child. So in some ways it circles back to the whole purpose of the field.
I think it's very interesting in the process of the discussion. And you also point this out in the introduction, there's sort of a, not really a parapraxis, but a misunderstanding that happens between two of the contributors. There's Laura Silber contributes a vignette, right, to the discussion. She talks about a child who, in very difficult circumstances, very difficult inner family circumstances, utters the phrase, as a toddler, "I a boy." So the kid specifically does not say "I'm a boy," it says "I a boy." And I think you rightly point out in your introduction and in your summary of the discussion how there's a world of difference between those two utterances, and it gets taken up by Wiggins in later on in the discussion, saying that the kid, he understood, the kid said, "I'm a boy," which is very different from what was what was said, that the kid said, "I a boy," and there's like just a very, very minor, very subtle difference in that sound, but a world of difference in meaning, possibly. We don't know, right? And that seems to relate, or at least to me, seems to relate to some of the issues that were raised also in the papers. I guess mostly from a Lacanian point of view, the gap that starts to open as soon as language is acquired. as soon as we leave, like this sort of, I guess the natural development, if there is ever any such thing, but as soon as language is introduced, that goes out the window, right? And the world of meaning opens up.
Yeah, I imagine we both have things to say about this, because I think it was kind of almost like the pivot of our introduction to the dialogue, and became quite a significant moment that we realized just had a lot to say about the different tensions throughout the dialogue. It was, as you were saying, this kind of misunderstanding, although it was a productive misunderstanding, I think, where Laurel discusses a child who the details are highly disguised to protect confidentiality, but basically the child loses their father under quite traumatic circumstances, is hearing a lot about their father, through the family, through family discussions, and at some point, and has never met the father, because the father died before the child was born, but at some point starts to utter the phrase, "I, a boy." And Laurel basically, wanted to say that this phrase required unpacking for its many possible meanings, some of which might relate to the child's potential identification with the father, or wish to see the father, or mourn the father, or whatever else. And Tobias called attention to some of the dangers of this way of thinking around how it might presume that if this kind of trauma is worked through, that that would resolve any of the issues around gender that the child might be communicating. So a sort of pathological view of transness could be at play here, or there's a danger of it being at play, because it could, the idea could be this child is experiencing some gender confusion, but once it works out its problems with its father, the child will identify as the girl that it was assigned at birth. But of course, what we pointed out was when Tobias was talking about this, he was using the phrase, "I'm a boy," whereas Laurel quoted the child saying, "I, a boy." And we thought that actually these two phrases also are quite different. As you said, there's a mere difference of one letter, but "I'm a boy" is something that is much more recognizable, to do a statement of identity. It says, "I am this," which could be counterposed to "I am not that." It's kind of more easily politicized. So there's a lot of other kind of ways that we can understand that phrase than "I, a boy," which is a lot more enigmatic. And so in some sense, we thought that just speaks to larger questions around what is the role of psychoanalysis in thinking about gender, and in what ways should psychoanalysis be tasked with kind of unpacking the multiple meanings of a gender identification versus, what's the role of clinical work in, supporting someone's gender identity, once they've declared it, and helping them, experience it in a tolerable way in a society that might not be particularly tolerant.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I would just add, I think this is just other words around sort of the same issue, but I think it's also a technical question around how to both take really any patient's words, but certainly a trans patient's words, both seriously and as open to possibilities of meaning, sort of holding them open and taking them seriously, which I think every contributor speaks to in a variety of ways. I think Tobias at some point has a really nice language about, can affirmation not be foreclosure, but the affirmation of existence, which I think is about taking something seriously as it is. And there, and that Laurel certainly, I think really everyone has different ways of talking about this tension. You know, it can, other words that can be around it are things like taking something at face value. But I think that can be a bit, or at least can be heard as a bit dismissive of that register too, which is how someone means something when they say it, right?
I like how you put that, Hannah, because that is, I think, one of the issues is when people are, I think, concerned about psychoanalysis being, you know, undermining of someone. It is precisely this idea that, oh, by listening to the unconscious, you're trying to catch someone out in, you know, something and prove that they didn't really mean what they intended. But I think this idea of being open to the possibilities that appear in someone's speech is a nicer way of putting what the project is about, right? Which is, it is absolutely taking them at their word, but acknowledging that those words can mean many things.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very interesting. Yeah, Hannah, please go ahead.
Just one more thing about that is I do think it's difficult technically to hold both of those, right? To really take someone's word seriously and hold space for all the potential meanings. I don't think that's an easy task, that's all.
Yeah. Yeah, while you were talking, I was just thinking, I think it's Oren who brings that up, Oren Goslan, the image of the Russian doll, right? That you unpack layers and then you get to a kernel, you get to something that is true and authentic. And I think that's an illusion that psychoanalysis tries to do away with, but that, I mean, we see analysts and we see ourselves to an extent fall into that trap also all the time, right? We want to get to something solid to hold on to. And what you were just saying is actually, instead of narrowing it down to a kernel, I guess a better approach might be to opening it up, right? To not to make it more narrow, but to actually to enrich an utterance with meaning, right? It might mean that, but it means a lot more different things as well. It's overdetermined, right?
Yeah, I really like that. I mean, it makes me think of, I think Laurel points to this as well, about how with children, that's, it's always true, and it's all the more true with children who have different levels of a grasp of language and can have less capacity to say all that they mean, even than a, you know, none of us can ever say all that. I don't even know what that statement means, but children have even more of a need to have a kind of expanded listening, right? That all that's trying to be said in whatever words one is able, a child is able to use to say them can be heard. There's even more of a risk, in other words, of keeping it not expanded.
Yeah, I mean, I think something you pointed out, Hannah, in the introduction is that also, while a lot of us are familiar with this sort of Lacanian emphasis on the ultimate kind of barriers to complete understanding or the impossibility of, you know, totally getting what something means, or the opacity, you know, of every person. There is also the importance of particularly a young person feeling that they can be understood, that you know, their caregivers are making an attempt to translate and contain, or however you want to put it, what it is that they're communicating. And I think that's something, yeah, that Laurel was emphasizing as well, that part of why she really makes a strong case for play therapy as a kind of dying art can be really, really fundamental in allowing, you know, something that a child is unable to express to find some means of having expression and being understood.
I just thought it might not even be about you know, actually needing to be understood, but I guess, needing to get a sense that there's someone's trying to understand, right?
Yeah, I think that's a better way of putting it.
And what I was just thinking about, and I think this also came up a lot in the discussion, but also in some of the papers, the problem of abstraction, right? Because whenever we talk about trans people, or especially I think trans children, there's always, you know, this, I guess, almost like a stereotype, the trans kid. And I mean, clinical experience, and especially psychoanalytic clinical experience, tells us there's no such thing. We're like the single case study, I think, is something really important that we could bring to the table of this like increasingly polarized field, right? And I think it's polarized, or the possibility for it to be so polarized is exactly because we tend to talk so much in abstractions, and it doesn't do justice. It doesn't do justice to all the single subjectivities that we encounter in the consulting room. There's no such thing as the trans kid.
It's such a good point, and it makes me wonder why. I mean, I'm thinking about your point about how that contributes to the polarization, because of course it's easy to have clean ideas, I guess, when they're about generalities as opposed to the particular. And I wonder why that is, that that happens more in this area.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And yeah, we did try to highlight that, you know, our wager is that this kind of question can only be approached through, you know, the singular experience of each case. But I guess, I mean, one of the things we also touched on was just how the experience of gender and the struggle to inhabit a gender is both something very universal that I think all of us have experience with. Maybe some of us are less willing to acknowledge it than others, but nevertheless, I think it's a universal problem, and yet also extremely personal for each individual. So it's that kind of tension that I think contributes to this difficulty in thinking about, this temptation to overgeneralize.
It also makes me think about, well, I guess two related thoughts. I was thinking back to the beginning of our discussion around the lawsuits everywhere, and just how it's such a different way of thinking, because when you turn to the law, you're making, you know, generalities with a capital G, you know, in the most severe form of that, and that it is such a different framework thinking about every individual and in their specificity than rules under the law.
I think it might be worth mentioning, I just found this really fascinating in the just the way in which that kind of trying to project into the mind of the child is at play when it comes to, you know, people in the field of the law trying to decide on these things, with the UK High Court decision, which has since been overturned. But the reasoning of the judges for why people under the age of 16 should not access puberty blockers was not simply that they said that those young people didn't have the capacity to consent, but what they didn't have the capacity to consent to was not simply puberty blockers, but in the judge's reasoning, it was the rest of the transition that awaited them if they began puberty blockers. So it was this very strange kind of temporal reasoning of, once they start on this path, they're inevitably going to carry on. That was what the judges believed. And so they cannot consent to this future that awaits them, even though it hasn't yet happened. And I just found that so fascinating as kind of the problem that the law constructed for itself, which seems a bit out of touch with precisely the reality of each individual child who's navigating this question.
I was just thinking, and I hope you don't perceive this as overly critical, but I think the special issue that you edited is sort of, I mean, we talk about this issue of abstraction a lot, but why did you decide to, I mean, not have case presentations in the special issue? Because that would have been, right, then we would have had singularities that might have been discussed, which would have been very interesting as well, I think. Any thoughts on that? Or did the thought ever cross your minds? I mean, is that something you would have been interested in?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. It's a good question.
Yeah.
That's Jordan.
I mean, it's funny. I think you're absolutely right. We didn't really discuss it very much, either for or against. I think we were both thrilled when Laurel did offer a vignette because it really felt like it grounded the conversation in a way that, you know, it maybe took a bit of time to get there. But I suppose, I mean, there, you know, there's the reality of just the difficulty of sharing such sensitive information about young people.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And...
But I think it might also have to do with countertransference again, because I think like the accounts that I have heard, not just read, but also heard in clinical discussions with colleagues, something very disconcerting tends to happen. Like, I don't know, like the anxiety that we've been talking about a lot, also now in our conversation, I think that really comes up in the consulting room. And it's, I think people tend to act, people tend to do things, like clinicians tend to do things in the consulting room with trans people that they would usually argue against doing. I don't know, at least from my experience. And that in combination with the vulnerability that we talked about, I think that's explosive material.
That makes sense to me. I mean, one other aspect that's just coming to mind is that, you know, the writing about gender, and I think trans issues in particular within psychoanalysis, often is at the edge between psychoanalytic thinking and, say, gender theory. And that the people who are also drawn to this tend maybe to also have a bit more theoretical, abstract way of approaching it. I mean, this is just a side piece, but I do think just an affinity for that level of discussion more so.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that is kind of one of the challenges of trying to create a dialogue between people who might be more used to clinical thinking in the domain of the vignette versus people who have this interest, you know, who, as you were saying, are kind of on the edge of gender theory, or that might be their main kind of area, that they are quite different, like, methodologies of, like, how you think about a problem.
Uh-huh. I think also
Go ahead, Hannah.
I have my own reservations around published work on, you know, deep investigations of clinical cases in a published form, just in terms of, I mean, there's both, I think there's actual new privacy, speaking of laws, around it, but then also just, you know, it is such a tricky issue to figure out how to do that, or in what form that makes sense, and what the, you know, there's so much in that around privacy of work.
Yeah, definitely. It's... It's a conundrum, right? But I was thinking with the vignette that Laurel Silver was presenting. I mean, there's so much we don't know just because we're not. I mean, we hear very little about. We hear some things about the case, but we're not interacting with the child. We're not getting, I don't know, a protocol, like a transcript of a session, for example. So we're not like this. This utterance, I mean, it takes on a world of meaning because it's abstract, right? It's abstract to us because we're not there, we're not involved.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the best we can hope for in that kind of situation where there are limitations on the detail you can share is that it at least opens up, new ways of listening for the person who engages with the material, so that when they are in a clinical situation, if they work clinically, even if they haven't learned everything about the case, they have a different way of thinking and hearing than they did before.
Right. I was wondering, sort of in closing, because we're already over the 50-minute mark, I was wondering about a point you were making towards the end of your introduction, about, I guess, the tension between affirmation and neutrality. And you introduce a third term, which could be acceptance, right? as a clinical stance, I guess, on how to receive trans kids in the consulting room, but probably also how to think about them in more public discussions. Could you say a bit about that tension and the third term you're introducing, acceptance, and what it could bring to our discussions?
Sure. I can say something and then Jordan, you can add whatever. I think it has to do with what we were talking about a little bit ago around how to both take someone's word seriously and be open to all possibilities within them, in that, I don't know if we're particularly committed to the term acceptance itself, but what we were trying to get at was that, with neutrality, what can come across or be sort of spoken as under the guise of neutrality can actually be a good deal of skepticism, right? So the way that responding, I think this is something that Tobias points out very well around the ways that a certain kind of interpretive stance can communicate a good deal that doesn't feel particularly neutral around in relation to what a patient is saying. And that acceptance, I think for me, one of my favorite definitions of neutrality is the acceptance of everything that a patient brings in and everything that a patient is. It points to the receptivity that I think neutrality as a concept in my mind is supposed to get at, that the openness about it, the openness to everything without taking a stance on with one part of the patient, et cetera. So that's the way we are trying to differentiate between different positions that can be under the term neutrality. And then in terms of affirmation on the other side, the reason we like the term acceptance versus affirmation is the ways that affirmation can be a kind of shoring up process. So back to the metaphor you were using between opening up versus closing down, that certain kinds of affirmation can seem to close down possibility, as if this is, Eve makes this point, I think, in the discussion well, and in her piece around the way that it can be a kind of, as if that's the end of the story, kind of period, right? As opposed to a positive engagement, but that also leaves open the possibility for what this unique individual means and all that they might mean in saying the statement. So those were the kinds of what we were trying to point out as potential pitfalls as trying to have a stance of both, again, openness and seriousness, or acceptance was, I think, the word that seemed to hold that for us. I don't know if you want to add to that, Jordan.
I think I would just add, I learned a lot from our contributors about this, the idea of affirmation. The signifier, I think, largely is to do with what in this conversation was to do with this idea of the gender affirmative model of care. And there were some very astute criticisms that some of the contributors made around the problems with this model in terms of, as Hannah was saying, this idea of it shoring up something rather than investigating, but also that it kind of presumes that underneath it all is some authentic gender identity that just needs to be uncovered, and that this isn't a very psychoanalytic way of thinking about subjectivity. But Tobias, I think, made an important point as well, which is that if you live in a transphobic society or a society that's very hostile to gender diversity, perhaps the only way in which you can engage in a psychoanalytic process or a process of self-exploration is if something is affirmed, as if there is a little support for you to hold on to, whether that's, obviously your pronouns being recognized or maybe something a bit further than that, as a way of, engaging with this kind of process at all. So I think it was in sort of trying to navigate those different ways of thinking about the concept of affirmation that we landed on this idea of acceptance.
Thanks very much for pointing that out. And I think, I guess time will tell if it's going to be a useful term that might, be taken up by the psychoanalytic community. I definitely thought it was worth having a third term that's in between this tension of neutrality and affirmation.
It's always worth having a third, isn't it?
definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, guys, we're all nearing the 1 hour mark. I wanted to thank you very much for coming on today and talking with me. It was a very interesting discussion. And I was just wondering if you had anything to add that we haven't touched and that you felt like was really important to still add to our discussion.
Not particularly. I mean, I just want to say thank you, Sebastian, for such a thoughtful series of questions and for engaging with this special issue so thoroughly and with such great kind of care and attention. It was really nice to get to discuss it with you. And I hope it's not that long, so I hope it encourages people to read it because we'd really love
definitely.
To hear listeners' thoughts on it.
Yes, I'd really encourage the audience to get the special issue and read it. It's a fascinating read and something very new that's developing also as a method probably to discuss clinical and theoretical issues. So thanks very much for doing that.
Yes, I second all of that. And I guess just a final shout out to our contributors for, you know, just thank them for doing this work of speaking with one another and to us about all of this and allowing us to think more deeply in all of these ways, in addition to thanking you, Sebastian, for having us here.
Thank you very much, and I hope we can continue this conversation in one way or another at some point. Thanks very much. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.